Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report, a very special treat, a guest I've wanted to have on for a long, long time, Dr. Naomi Wolf. I'm sure you all know her. She is the both tech entrepreneur and publisher at Daily Clout. She has a long history of great books and accomplishments, and we're going to be talking about some of those today and why she never gives up and has accomplished so much. So, Dr. Wolf, thank you for joining us. May I call you Naomi?
Please call me Naomi. And, you know, I'm such an admirer of yours, so it's very exciting for me to be in human-to-human communication with you. You know, I so often process what you present and think about it, and it's very influential to me. So thank you so much.
So let me just mention two of your accomplishments that first got turned me into a huge Naomi Wolf fan. The first was, I don't know if you remember this, when the new Green Deal first came out, you did a video that just ripped it to shreds and unpacked it and really demonstrated an incredible knowledge of both human rights and property rights and how they relate. And
thank you.
It was just, it was a thing of beauty. Do you, when was that?
That was 2017, I believe.
Yeah, 2017. And then you were the person, and I use this line all the time, who as soon as the vaccine passports, digital IDs came out, you said, "This is the end of human liberty. I'm a tech entrepreneur and I understand what this is and you need to understand what it is." And you've been very, you know, early on and clear. And that was a very important warning to go out. So, yeah, those were the, and you can tell from the response on social media, you certainly paid the price for doing this.
What should I, may I call you Catherine?
Yes, please, please.
It's really interesting and, you know, prescient characteristically of you to think about the Green New Deal video in relation to what's going on right now, because right. It really was a harbinger, wasn't it? I mean,
yes.
That was 2017. I was astonished. It was a very viral video. I didn't expect it to be. And I was astonished to read the text, which is what we do at Daily Clout. We actually read the text of the bills and explain them. Astonished to read that bill and find, and it was getting so much good press by all the legacy media. And no one had read it. And when you actually read it, it was this shocking document that, right. That basically foreshadows everything we're fighting right now. It was pure Marxism. And I'm, you know, the daughter of a you know, communist. I mean, I then from a long line of socialists. I mean, I'm not someone to be knee-jerk kind of ideologically inflammatory by throwing around the word communism, but it actually was communism. It literally took
right.
A higher sector of the American economy and put it in the hands of a Politburo, a 15-person unelected committee that would make decisions. And it literally did things that I was shocked to see then, but have become so much of the fabric of the battles we fight now. It literally allocated to certain groups of Americans, like people of color and people, you know, facing discrimination and so on, rights and property rights and access and resources that were not being available, made available to other Americans. It was thoroughly unconstitutional and racist and right. Stunned to see it. But, you know, that turns out to be like straws in the wind from several years ago that indicate who these people really are, you know, that have come so much to the fore since the pandemic.
Right. And, you know, I hate to say this. I ran into it when I worked in the Bush administration. And you saw it on right and left. It was all spectrums where you just had groups of people who thought taking other people's property was just hunky-dory. You know, it's like, what a great way to make money. So, it's always been there, but it was, you know, it certainly came out of the closet with the new Green Deal.
Yeah.
So let's turn to your book, because I got your book when it first came out, but knowing you were coming on, I finally got the chance to finish it. And first, what I have to tell everybody, it's called The Bodies of Others. Here you can see a picture of it, or you can see the book itself. And first of all, what you need to know is it's very, very well written.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons it's so effective is you really feel the tyranny. you really feel what it's like to be in the tyranny. I was lucky because I was, when the lockdowns came, I was in the northern part of the Netherlands. And by and large, we just decided not to participate in the whole affair and were able to avoid it. And, or a lot of the tyranny. And of course, you're in New York, you're in Oregon, you know, you're right in the thick of it. And so you feel the damage. But the other thing you do is you go back and forth in several chapters between the games they're playing on the lockdowns and what it does to property rights and economics. You're an entrepreneur. So you have a great feeling for what this is doing to people's businesses, what it's doing to their, you know, their ownership of real estate. You go through the moratorium on rent. And you really get that balance back and forth between the health and well-being of the people and what the interference with their economic assets and property is. And so you seem to have a picture of that, an integrated picture that very few people had at the time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And, you know, I really appreciate your focusing on these themes. And I especially appreciate, you know, the tech world especially is so bizarrely sexist. And it was right. Surprising coming from journalism and publishing, which is a little more kind of egalitarian in terms of gender. But where I'm going is I appreciate you noticing that I bring expertise as a tech entrepreneur, which literally almost no one, you know, uses as a term to describe me, but it is true. I right. failed to succeed at a tech company. And the reason I mention that is it allowed me to see specifically where the money right. flows as a result of lockdown. So lockdown was such a shock, and it was represented as a public health crisis and solution. And a lot of people, a lot of smart people have deconstructed what a useless public health solution that was. But to me, as someone who's in the tech space, as they say, a tech entrepreneur, I immediately realized that what the tech companies were doing, and the tech companies were very much partners in the lockdown and the messaging around the lockdown, and they're invested in the vaccines. What I understood they were doing was erasing the advantage that the competitive advantage that the real world has over digital platforms. Right. In other words, if you're Nintendo, which was a dying brand, you know, its profits were going like that, well, lock children up, keep them from playing in person, and you revive your brand and the profits go up to the right. If you're Amazon, you're competing with main streets, and in Britain with high streets, you're competing with mom and pop shops. You're competing with little stores and restaurants and grocery stores and boutiques where the shop owners know your name, or, you know, that your granddaughter just graduated from kindergarten, or whatever that advantage is that the real world has. Well, you just lock those down, and then Amazon's net revenue goes up 23%. These companies, one after another, Microsoft, Google, Zoom, you know, a brand we barely right. heard of, their average net revenue was up 23% during 2020 to 2021 to 2022. So why would they ever give that up, right? And, you know, social distancing, it's not even a term we have in the West. It's a very Marxist, Chinese communist term, social distancing. We're a nation of individuals. We have individual laws, individual rights. But by making, you know, masking, by making the in-person space so uncomfortable, so miserable, of course you rush home, take off your mask, you know, cuddle up with your computer and get onto digital platforms. So I did recognize the money flow that was being rediverted by really criminalizing or putting a levy on in-person communications, communion, gathering. You know, tech hates spaces where they're not harvesting data or making money. And some right. of those are in-person schools and universities and churches and synagogues, right. you know, town halls, but especially the first two. So just make it, you know, impossible to have an in-person classroom. You don't just get to benefit from distance learning, which was, again, a dying breed because no one wanted distance learning if they could have in-person learning. But you also get to harvest the data of every single one of those kids and young adults who's being forced online, which is so lucrative. So, yes, I did recognize that. And I guess the other thing I recognized as a tech CEO is, you mentioned it, this video I did in March of 2021, I believe, warning people about vaccine passports, which again, were being rolled out with almost no questioning as a positive good. Oh, we just bring our vaccine passport and then we can all go back to our normal lives. Well, it's, you know, it takes minimal knowledge of digital technology. Yes. But luckily, I have that minimal knowledge to know that, you know, there's no such thing as just a vaccine passport. If it's digital, you can load onto it in 20 minutes with like very basic coding, the person's entire credit history, their social media score, you know, from compliance to dissent. You can load onto it all of their medical history. You can load onto it, you know, you can turn on or off their ability to go through a toll system or to get onto a train or to get onto a plane. Literally, there's no limit to how many functionalities you can load onto, quote unquote, the back end. You can load an Apple wallet onto it. You can turn on and off their bank account. And so I predicted, you know, what we saw in 2022, I believe, with the truckers protest in Canada, where, you know, sure enough, when there were dissidents causing trouble, demanding their rights, their bank accounts were simply switched off. So there's like, if they really cared about just your vaccine status, they would have given you a piece of paper. Right. The minute digital, you know, endless numbers of other functionalities can be loaded onto it. And then you get a social credit score system like China, which effectively manages to the minutest degree, a billion people and keeps there from being revolution in that country.
Right. Now you also, by focusing on the rent moratorium, you also talked a lot about what it did to the small, both the small business owner and the small real estate owner. And I thought the section where you go into what it does to the small real estate owner was very compelling, because if you take the shutdown of small business, you take the a remarkable amount of layoffs, and then you take the hammering the small real estate owner, you're talking about wiping out the income for a significant number of Americans.
Right. I'm so glad. Like, this is one of the many reasons I love you as an intellectual. You're literally the first person to talk to me about this point in my book. And I think it's one of the most important points.
Right. I agree.
Thank you. And here's why. Property, you know, the small property owner, that usually represents an immigrant family's or a woman's or family of color's first asset that can be passed on to future generations, and people's homes, if they can pay off their homes or rent them out or just own them, are middle class people's great, you know, only source of wealth, really, and primary. And I guess I have a very emotional relationship to this because I was a super broke single mom for 12 years, but I kept scrambling to make mortgage payments on this one piece of property, a home I bought, you know, with my parents, for my parents. And that effort, which was very difficult, you know, month by month, like literally, you know, I had to scrimp and save in other ways to, you know, make those mortgage payments.
It's like war.
It's like war.
It's a war. Right.
It's a war. But it's especially a war if you don't come from money or if you're disadvantaged in other ways. Right. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that struggle really gave me a sense of empathy and commonality for all the families who are scrambling so hard to put aside that money to make those mortgage payments. And that's their wealth. That's their security. That's their asset that they can pass on to the next generation. And also property ownership in this country is quite egalitarian. You know, now you can be, you know, black or white or an immigrant or not an immigrant or a woman or a man, you can own property. So recognizing that, that and how fragile that is and how hard people work to secure it, I was horrified, you know, when I saw that there was a rent moratorium that the CDC, put out. An eviction moratorium. And it sounds like I'm being, Daddy Warbucks, of course you want to evict these poor people onto the street. But no, so many of those landlords are small landlords who depend upon that rental income to pay their own mortgages or to, you know, keep the upkeep up. continue to own it, pay the taxes, you know, have their own little bit of passive income coming in, pay for their kids' college education, whatever it may be. And so you block that with what is the CDC? They don't have regulatory powers, as
right.
Complained. They are just advisory, but somehow they had the role of saying no evictions for 6 months. Well, it was predictable what would happen. All right. of those millions of those small property owners, it is a business, would be forced by the end of those 6 months to sell. And I remember, never forget, in January of 2022, as I recall, I was looking at residential apartment sales in Harlem. And I saw, because I was looking around in Harlem, and I saw this dramatic drop in values across the board. Prices slashed. Well, I knew exactly what that was. It was January 15th. It was the end of the 6 month moratorium. It was just enough time for the evictions to take place, for these poor landlords to paint their apartments and put them on the market in a fire sale. And who scooped up residential real estate? BlackRock. Turning us into a nation, it's their goal, of renters, people who don't have the security or the political resistance to be actual property owners.
Let me just stop you there, because the Fed voted for the going direct reset in August 2019. And then between that time and March 2020, they, at the beginning of the pandemic, they inject $5 trillion into the economy, including directly with the help of BlackRock.
Wow.
Okay. And when you inject $5 trillion directly into economy, you're going to kick off hyperinflation, but they didn't, because they shut down half of the economy. So now, John Titus just made a great video about the sort of whale deposits. That $5 trillion ends up in rich people's accounts. It's remarkable how much it went to a very targeted group of people who are now flush with mammoth amounts of cash, and you just happen to shut down another part of the economy where people are forced to sell cheap. What a coincidence.
Oh, my goodness. So do you think that was part of, it's all clearly—
I think it was absolutely part of an integrated plan. It was a fundamental reengineering of the economy. And there are other aspects we can talk about, it because there are more shenanigans going on. But the reality is, when you know this, because you have lots of experience in government, around government, with public policy, when you are trying to stop a policy, it's important to understand whether it's a failed policy or a successful policy. And offsetting the inflation of the going direct reset with deflation through the pandemic was a highly successful policy.
Successful for— sounds like
successful for the people leading it. In other words, if I want to, I'm coming into a period where I can't keep the promises I've made politically. I can't keep my retirement promises. I can't keep all sorts of other promises. And people are going to start asking questions and try and undo the secrecy and discover that I've broken the law and I've stolen a whole bunch of money. So there's been a bank robbery, and I don't want to tell you that the money's been stolen out the back door. So what do? I just move you into a situation of control and repression, where I literally have so much control that I can turtle through this change. You know, it's the consolidation of a financial coup. And so, you know, but at the same time, I can't say, oh, well, I'm the central banker, so I'm just going to lock you down financially, introduce CBDC and use financial repression to let you down hard. I can't say that. So instead, I have these official narratives. I have these stories. And the central bankers, in my opinion, are hiding behind the healthcare skirts. If you look at the WHO treaty, they're creating mechanisms to use their global laboratories to give them the power to jump in and intercede in any local economy or local politics. You know, it's a pretext for local control when they need to land their armies. But the beauty of the bodies of others is that you really give people a sense for what, you know, that back and forth, because you can't look at it as just an economic play. It's a human experience, and You know, they have to keep the humans off balance and incoherent and not seeing the game. How do do this? Right.
Totally.
And you've done, your power is you keep helping them see the game.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, you know, you and I both have been in the rooms where those decisions are made. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that what I guess I recognize so much about your ability to look at the chessboard is that most people who haven't been behind the scenes in the rooms where power unfolds itself don't understand that the goal is identified first and the story comes later to get people to sign up at the goal.
Right. The dinner with the hedge fund manager is a hoot. That's the scene in the book. So the bodies of others, I will warn you, the book is so effective in getting you to feel the tyranny that you really, I had to stop and pray occasionally to remember I'm a Christian. I shouldn't be thinking that. So it was tough. Okay. I want to next talk about one of your great accomplishments, the Pfizer documents. So great judge, great decision, forces Pfizer to come clean on 75, and instead of getting 75 years before they disclose, you know, their documents, the judge says, okay, you've got to disclose documents. Well, what then comes out is a tsunami of documents that requires incredible expertise to read. It looks like a hopeless situation, like the truth is going to get buried in the tsunami. But come to the rescue, Dr. Naomi Wolf. Tell us what you did.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's an extraordinary story. So as you mentioned, for people who may not know, there was a successful lawsuit by an attorney named Aaron Seary that compelled the FDA to release these tens of thousands of documents that were internal Pfizer documents. And the FDA had requested the judge that they be kept hidden for 75 years. And yes, the judge did not agree, so they were released. And just as you say, I was worried that they would be lost. So voluminous and so technical, so hard to follow if you're not a scientist or a doctor. So we put out the call on my site, Daily Clout, and I was supported in this by putting out the call on Steve Bannon's site, War Room, which is one of the great ironies of the history of this moment, because opposite places politically, but we're very aligned on the Constitution and, you know, obviously medical consent, which is kind of implied by the Constitution. And so we asked for experts, and to my amazement, 3,500 highly credentialed doctors, nurses, pathologists, radiologists, cardiologists, medical fraud investigators, biostatisticians, research scientists, lab scientists, biological scientists, all joined this volunteer effort. And also amazingly, and this is why I, you know, really think we're in a highly metaphysical time, there are things happening that can't explain in kind of ordinary history terms. But one of them is this woman, Amy Kelly, appeared and volunteered to be our project director. And she somehow managed to turn these 3,500 people around the world into a highly effective intellectual fighting force of six teams, producing these reports that I trained them to write in language that everyone could understand. And so now, and they're what's in the Pfizer documents. And you can go to the upper right-hand corner of Daily Clout and you can see them.
You have a book now with, I think, 40 reports, right?
Correct. And there's a sequel with the, you know, volume two, and that's on Amazon. And it's the War Room Daily Clout Pfizer documents in a book format. But sadly, what they found is the greatest crime against humanity in recorded history. And specifically, in the form of these mRNA injections. Specifically, what is the centerpiece of the Pfizer documents as it emerged is a 360-degree attack on human reproduction, and specifically on destroying women as reproductive.
Right. And as it came out, is this what you expected to find? Did you realize how extraordinary what you would find would be?
Certainly not. I mean, I thought, and there had been kind of stories and leaks and documents appearing prior to our teams digging into these documents, I thought I'd find a greedy pharmaceutical company that was cutting corners. I had no idea I would find, as I put it elsewhere, if the Pfizer documents are a mystery novel, the central question is, how do we keep women from reproducing? I had right. no idea that I would find, a Mengele type science in which otherwise presumably civilized people are calmly creating charts showing how they're ruining women's menstrual cycles and menstrual health and reproductive health in 20 different categories with thousands of women in each category, and kept going. You know, I didn't think I would find charts where they show, oh, it's so appalling, Catherine. They show, they know they're poisoning vaccinated women's breast milk with the lipid nanoparticles covered right. in polyethylene entering the breast milk. And they literally have charts where they put, you know, these babies have swelling of their tissue. These babies have fever. These babies are vomiting. These babies are inconsolable. Charts, you know, showing how they're entering babies with poisoned breast milk. I didn't think I would find like bizarre sexually psychopathic studies, like they mate vaccinated male rats with unvaccinated female rats. Then they sacrifice both genders. Then this is a respiratory pathogen ostensibly, right, Catherine?
Right.
They're not lungs. They don't dissect them and look at their lungs. They look at their genitals. They dissect the cells of their reproductive organs. I didn't think I would find horrific secrets that they were keeping from the American people. For instance, Pfizer defines in the documents exposure to the vaccine as including skin contact and inhalation. So shedding is a thing.
Right.
But also they warn the vaccinated men in their study not to have intercourse with unvaccinated women of childbearing age. And that if they do so, to use two reliable forms of contraception. So what this means is that they knew that there's something they still are not telling us about in the body fluids of vaccinated men that is injurious either to their female sex partners or to the zygotes of the the embryos that are conceived. They knew, this is so like chilling to consider. They knew that they were packing, like all those spokespeople that were paid to tell us that the injection stayed in the deltoid, it wasn't true. They knew, and there's a chart that Dr. Robert Chandler, who's a distinguished sports medicine physician who's treated the Angels and the Lakers, he identified it. It shows that the lipid nanoparticles biodistribute within 48 hours all over the body, accumulating in the brain, the liver, the spleen, the adrenals, and if you're a woman, in your ovaries. But what Pfizer didn't tell us, in addition to that, is that with every injection, more accumulates in your ovaries. So with first one, you're packing your ovaries with lipid nanoparticles, second one more so, first booster more so, second booster more so, you know, predictably you're getting horrible menstrual symptoms.
Right.
Among.
So it's fair to say it's not only Pfizer who knows this, it's the FDA who knows all of this.
Without a doubt. And Catherine,
right.
You've been at the highest levels of government. It's not just the FDA, it's the White right. House, the CDC, because you know, like, it's such a relief for me to talk to you because you know the chain of command. You know that right. if someone's murdering the American people and sterilizing them and killing babies, I mean, one of the chilling phrases in the Pfizer documents is these two babies died in utero from, quote unquote, Pfizer's words, transplacental exposure to the vaccine.
Right. Right.
And now a 13 to 20% drop in live births in Western Europe and North America. If you're the White House and you find out this is happening, those people, you know, are going to go to jail. They have to hire lawyers in a heartbeat. So no one's going to burn that kind of political capital without the White House giving its blessing and right. the CDC and the
right.
FDA.
This was all the way from the top.
Totally. No
all
question.
The way from the top. And I have to tell you, it goes further, because if you look at who's investing, who's financing the whole thing, the financiers need to be totally and completely on board. I mean, to me,
more about that.
Well, you can't remember what was that famous thing when James Carville said, "When I die and come and I'm reincarnated, I want to come back as the bond market because you can control everybody." So if you look at the, by that point, the Treasury in the mechanisms that we have, it doesn't have to be this way, but in the mechanisms we have, is 100% totally dependent on the New York Fed as their depository. You have $21 trillion missing. I mean, I don't know if you know this. I started in 2000 and have published every year since then reports on all the money missing from the federal government. And what I said starting in 2000, if we don't stop this, they're going to have to lower life expectancy. The only way you can balance the, there was a huge budget deal that busted in 95. I don't know if you remember it. And I was told by the largest pension fund, the president of CalPERS, in the spring of 1997, he said, you don't understand, they've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. And he, I assume from talking with him that he was referring to the fury when they couldn't agree to a budget deal in October 1995 and some of the fear on the investment side of the things that had happened. And so I assumed he was referring to that. And interestingly enough, that was October 1995. In November 1995 was exactly when the predatory lending at HUD skyrocketed and OxyContin was approved by the FDA. And a process began, I call it the great poisoning, that started to steadily lower life expectancy. And that accelerated dramatically with the pandemic. And I kept saying, I don't know if you know Dr. Mark Skidmore. He's somebody you should definitely be in cahoots with. But there was money going missing. And I kept saying every year doing interviews and doing publishing things saying, if we don't solve this, they're going to have to lower life expectancy or delay the retirement age or dramatically inflate away the benefits or all three. And sure enough, with the great poisoning, they were lowering life expectancy, but it was not dramatic. It was sort of quiet and steady. Then in 2015, $6.5 trillion went missing, which was the biggest number. And a professor from Michigan State University, Dr. Mark Skidmore, heard me on a show and said, she must be wrong. It's impossible that the government would be missing more money than the entire budget. And he went to the DOD website and looked at the financials and said, oh my God, she's right. They're missing $6.5 trillion. And anyway, so he came in and did a survey that we published in 2017 saying the U.S. government is missing $21 trillion. They've never produced audited financial statements. They're wildly in violation of the constitutional and laws related to financial management. He produced the survey results, and I kept saying to him, Mark, you don't understand. If we don't do something about this, they're going to have to lower life expectancy. They're going to keep lowering life expectancy. And so when the pandemic...
So I can follow this. So important. Is that because there would be no money for Social Security?
What they had been doing is issuing Treasury securities and putting them in the pension funds while they're moving the assets out of the government. And so you've moved your assets into a new entity, and you've left your liability in the old entity. And the way you've done it is with Treasury. So everybody's pension funds are full of these Treasury securities that need to be inflated away, or the assets are gone elsewhere. So it's a coup. It's a financial coup. And the question is, how are you going to make good on these promises, which you can't make good on unless you get the assets, bring the assets back? And if you look at the laws related to financial management, the New York Fed is depository, in my opinion, is engaged in criminal. I mean, it's not legal if you're the depository to do illegal transactions. So if you, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, the stories of the man who has two families. He's got one paycheck and two families, and the first family doesn't know the second family exists. And it gets more and more dysfunctional to try and finance two families out of one paycheck. And finally, he just cuts the first family off. So it's a little bit like that, because now they have all the promises are coming due. And there is tremendous tension between managing the global empire you're trying to build, like the war in Ukraine, and making good on the retirement promises. So, for example, the interest on the federal debt just surpassed the military budget. So you've got, you know, if you look at the budget, you've got the retirement pot, you know, and social safety net, healthcare. You've got the military budget, and then you've got interest on the debt. So you've got the creditors, you've got the military who keeps the game going, and then you've got the retirees. And so the question is, how are you going to significantly reduce the size of the output, the cash output for this third one?
By killing off the retirees.
Well, if you look at what they're doing, it looks to me like a combination of things. One, you're using inflation. You know, so you're pumping up property and asset values in a way that brings in more taxes and reduces the real cost of the retirement benefits. So you're using inflation. You know, in some places like in Russia, France, they're moving the retirement age, you know, but then you're doing what I call the great poison. You're doing the slow kill. And it's many different things. It's far from just the injections. But you're absolutely bringing down life expectancy in a way which is helping to balance the budget. There's no doubt to me that this is, you know, if you combine this with the spraying and the food and all these other things, you're looking at a adjustment to the actuarial assumptions by doing a slow kill. I can't come up with another explanation. Can you?
Well, I mean, that's really interesting and very persuasive. I guess I've been focused on the role of China in manufacturing these injections, and my own original reporting showed that the SEC filing for 2021 for BioNTech, the subsidiary of Pfizer that manufactures them, transferred the IP to China, 100% completed for the SEC filing. To China. It doesn't say a Chinese individual. It doesn't say a Chinese company. It says to China. And China opened 14 manufacturing plants for this injection, which the Chinese people don't receive, and two in the United States in the last couple of years, one in Springfield, Mass., and one in Princeton, New Jersey. And I'm also very affected by the fact that 36,000 of the 42,000 adverse events in the Pfizer documents are in the United States or North America. The next largest tranche is Western Europe in order of political importance. And again, it's, you know, you will understand that is Germany, France, Britain, and then, you know, Greece, Spain, Italy, and all the rest of the world combined is only 7,000 adverse events. So there's a targeted on Western Europe and North America. And I guess I bring this up because I'm very influenced by my husband's analysis, because he spent 12 years in military intelligence and then in other intelligence, and he's shown me primary source documents that CCP working with the WHO, you know, and all of them in cahoots with the World Economic Forum, wants a world, and this may align with your world of the slow kill and balancing the US budget, but CCP wants a world in which, you know, as he's put it, the Chinese Communist Party wants our land. They're trying to buy it. They want our water resources. They want our energy resources. They want our ports. They want our energy grid. They don't want our population. You know, what you'll get is not only a slow kill, putting together your theory and my theory, you're going to get a world that's being re-engineered, essentially, in terms of populations, in which in 10 years, if you're right and I'm right, there's going to be the people who remember Western democracy are going to be dead or sterilized. The people who are living in those territories are going to be people who come from authoritarian regimes who don't have that history or expectation of not living in a feudal society. The people who were supposed to retire on non-existent money will be dead or incapacitated. Right. And there will be very restricted numbers of future generations. So I guess I guess what I'd conclude is that our theories kind of align, but there are multiple bad actors.
So my nickname for the secret governance system is, I call it Mr. Global, for want of a better word. And in my experience, Mr. Global was instrumental in bringing China up, investing in China, and using them in these various ways. And so I see China as, you know, they're going along with being used in these various ways, but I don't see them as beginning to have any control. You know, if you look at all the different ways they've been used to sabotage different interests within the United States, it's always, you know, a U.S. controller or a banking controller above them. And
so what's the role of Bill Gates in this kind of nefarious pantheon, in your view?
I think he's just one of the stooges. I mean, my guess is, if you look at the money, after he did the deal with the Department of Justice, he and the Gates Foundation was created, and they are essentially a proprietary. And I think some of this money has been circulated back into the Gates Foundation. A lot of the money Buffett's been made circulated into this pot of money, which is then used strategically to build central control. And he's one of the one of my favorite expressions is John Titus calls him and Fauci chew toys and Schwab. You know, these are the chew toys that will be thrown to the, you know, crowd when we're ready to kill somebody. But so I just think of him as a front. I don't think of him as being particularly powerful. He's just the front runner for that pot of money, which obviously has a lot of power to it. But if you look at the real decision making power, I don't think it rests in Bill Gates.
Right. Or in the Chinese Communist Party. I agree with you. I mean, I definitely see them as instrumentalized the way you do. But I also think it's one of these really interesting moments historically where you're going to at some point get like that circle of thieves who turn on each other and try to murder each other, because at some point these interests are not going to align. Right?
Right.
I don't think China will, you know, tolerate forever being the, you know, handmaiden of the globalists. And I think the globalists are probably underestimating this, you know, submissive willingness of China. And I think everyone's underestimating what always happens in revolutions of this kind, where, you know, your allies get thrown to the wolves the minute they're no longer useful to you.
Right. But I do think if we should wake up one day and have the Chinese governing us, we're toast.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I love the China. I studied Chinese in Hong Kong for a year. I was at Yale and China Language Institute. I love the Chinese, but you know something? They are the most deeply racist people I've ever loved. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are not going to have, if you look at what they've borne from the Western world since the Opium Wars, they're not going to have any sympathy for us. So I'm with you there. So I want to just jump to another great Naomi Wolf accomplishment. And that is, you know, I've seen a lot of great rants in my life, but I'm the daughter of the Ivy League. My grandfather was Dean of Wharton. My father was chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania. I graduated from Penn undergrad. I went to Wharton MBA. I'm watching what Penn is doing in terms of vaccine mandates and lockdown policies. And I can't even comprehend what is going on, and we'll talk about it in a second. But I never knew what to say about it because I was so stunned. I was a founder of the Council for Penn Women. They sent me a request asking me for donations for their women's sports. I said, wait a minute, I'm not giving you money. You're destroying women's sports. They're doing the, you know, I mean, so it's so mind-boggling what is happening to the Ivy League. So then you come along. You did a rant in front of Yale. So you graduated from Yale. You did a rant in front of Yale, which was the best. I can't tell you. I have two rants I love, and that is one of them. I was laughing. I was crying. I was jumping up and down and cheering. I was looking around to make sure nobody could see me because they would think I was. It was one of the best rants ever. Just talk about what happened.
Sure. Thank you. Well, I mean, this also, I don't mean to be such a fangirl, you'll have to forgive me, but a part of my sense of kind of excitement about talking to you is also that you come from this world of being inside these elite institutions. And so I think it's especially shocking to people like us who believed, I don't want to speak for you, but I believed some of the promises of a Yale, of a Penn, of Oxford. That they would stand for something.
They were for excellence.
They were for excellence.
They were for excellence.
Even if, you know, even if you lower the bar and might concede pre-2020 that they weren't always for excellence or that there were corporate pressures or financial pressures, right. I never in my life, as corrupt as any institution could be, would have thought they would traffic their own students' bodies.
Right.
And so what I found out, of course, as you did, all of us, that the Ivy Leagues are among the worst in mandating the, not just the injections, but the boosters, the bivalent boosters, which are, you know, test donor eat mice on healthy young adults who have no risk from COVID. But, you know, and even if they did, we've established by my experts that Pfizer knew the vaccines didn't stop COVID, but leaving that aside. So I was horrified to learn that my alma mater was planning to compel returning undergraduates to Yale to have the bivalent booster, or else they couldn't come back to campus this past spring semester. But the administration, meaning the president and the faculty, were exempt from it. I mean, that doesn't even, like, leaving aside everything else, that doesn't even fit science, you know, or a hypothesis of any kind of reason, right? So it's Yale completely abandoning its post-Enlightenment claim to, you know, being an institution of truth in any way. And the motto is Lux et Veritas. So, and also I'm a mom, and, you know, there's this interesting thing happening in parents of the Ivy League where none of us wants to go harangue the dean at our kids' school because they've really turned into these fascistic administrations where we're all afraid they'll punish our children, right? Or make their lives miserable. So, but nothing prevents us from protesting at other parents' kids' universities. Dissent. All this being said, I was truly appalled that these particular students were in danger, knowing what I know from the injection. For sure, if you've got 5,000 undergraduates, some women are going to be ruined reproductively before they've even had their kids. And some young men are going to have heart damage, pericarditis, myocarditis, heart transplants. I know two healthy young men now who've had to have heart transplants after the injection. So they were going to murder the kids or sterilize them, and certainly some of them. So I guess I just, you know, I was invited to protest. I guess it's a rant. I don't think of it as a rant. I think of it as what you see there is the energy of a mother trying to warn the world that young people were in danger, you know, trying to more of a mother bear kind of, you know, don't come near the cops.
Yeah, it was very mama bear, but it was very, you know, you're talking statistics, science. It's very high intellectual content, but the energy is definitely a mama bear.
Yeah. Well, I was also shocked to discover, I shouldn't be shocked by anything anymore, that why would they? I kept thinking, and you can, I'm sure, relate to this question. Rich people's children used to be the ones who were exempted from all the horrors, right? And these are rich. And I kept thinking, why would they, you know, they're getting calls from their alumni, they're getting calls from their donors. Why are they doing this financially? Why are they doing it? And then I found that actually Yale gets more from HHS than they do from tuition.
I remember that. But I think we have a great Salieri report called Control and Freedom Happen One Person at a Time. And another series of, it's 12 sections called Deep State Politics. Because when I litigated against the federal government for 11 years, and then there was another 4 years of hassle with the taxes. So it was a 15-year process, and I dealt with just about every kind of physical harassment and smear campaign. And I know you've dealt with a lot of that, too. I think that's how you met your husband. So, you know, I've seen all the tactics they can use to influence and control. And with the surveillance systems now, they are, you can't imagine how many people they have control files on, how many people they can coerce and blackmail, how many people won't stand up to them. You know, I've had an experience, not with Yale, but with Penn. I did something. I asked for the Penn financials when my brother was the dean of the law school.
Wow.
And I literally got a call. Now, it's legal. Any university is supposed to make their tax returns available publicly. It should be a public document. I got a call from my sister saying that the family was going to turn against me and drop me because she had gotten a call from my brother saying the provost had called him in the office and said if I insisted on getting the financial statements and the tax returns, you know, my brother said the provost said he would be fired. I don't believe that. I think it's exaggerating. But you see the, you know, the extent of the corruption. I only tell that story because I later published it. But you see the extent of the corruption where the university won't even let its tax, public statements that are supposed to be public, they won't even, you know, they'll do that kind of coercion to shut it down. So,
absolutely. I mean, right. You're a brave woman and you're exactly right. It's, you know, these universities are nonprofits and they're obligated by law to make their financial records transparent.
Right.
But also B, that story, as heartbreaking as it is, I think people who aren't in that network of privileged or elite education don't understand how coercive that can be, because what you have after that is you're part of a community of people who are surveilling you essentially, or who can cause you harm by ejecting you or through whom pressure can be put on you. And you know, it's also the flip side of it is that your network is your, you know, the doors open to you, the money coming into you, the, you know, the favors. Right. So it's almost like a mafia type system, you know, you're graduating right. from those universities or being part of that elite circle because you could be exiled.
So it was really interesting because by the time that process was over, you know, I'd been completely ripped out and was in a very different world because I tried to build my new companies around people who understood how bad it was, didn't want to be part of it. So I have an ally who says they pine for the treats of the tapeworm. My whole world was evolved around subscribers or other people who didn't pine for the treats of the tapeworm. They didn't, you know, they didn't care. But right. when you read the bodies of others, you feel your story from 2014 on of getting sort of torn out of the fabric. And I had to relive what that felt like reading your book. That was like, oh God. And you're so, you know, you're so extroverted. You love people. They love you. That had to have just been even harder for you than it was for me. It was just
cheating. It's to right. this day. Over. It's not over.
Right. It's not over. You're right. It's not over.
Painful. What can I say? You think people, you know, are your friends or your family and right. that they're not going to, you know, ostracize you because you disagree about something or because right. you're not injected with something that they're injected with. I mean, right. the fact that in this time in history in America is so surreal. But among the many, you know, shibboleths I've had to let go, I thought that, you know, the people who behaved irrationally are highly educated psychologists and educators and, you know, journalists and managing editors of media companies. And I've had to let go of my belief, you know, not just that the institutions are credible, but that people are credible that I right. loved and trust.
So my next Naomi Wolf accomplishment that I just loved, you did an interview with Bobby Kennedy, and I think it was after he published Letter for Liberals, and you're talking about, we're progressives, where did everybody else go? You know, we didn't change. Right. Everybody left us, and now it's like we're sitting on an island, the two of us, alone. What happens? And it was funny and it was sad and it was whatever, but you could feel your, you know, the fact that this is stupefying yeah. because you truly believe in being progressive and all the people who you thought were progressive, like disappeared into this authoritarian nightmare. And you're like, what happened?
I remember it well. I mean, there are so few people, you know, left to have that conversation with. It meant a lot right. to me. But yeah, it's tragic and mystifying. Yeah, I have no wisdom about it. I think people are when they're suffering from this delusion, it's beyond, you know, efforts like mass formation or the psychology right. of authoritarianism. I think something is stalking the planet, unlike anything we've in our...
Right, it's demonic. We're dealing with very demonic, you know, whether it's demonic in the material world or the spiritual world or both, you know, we're dealing. So two quick things before we close. I just have to say, I recommend it to everybody that they read your story of the orange cloud in New York. We were talking about it on Money Markets this week, and another great Naomi Wolf accomplishment. You're going to be the keynote speaker at Weston Price. So if people haven't gotten to hear or see you in person, here's the gist. I wanted to talk a little bit about mind control technologies and whether they've been part of the demonic part of the material world, but we don't have time to do that. But the thing I think most remarkable, I look back on all your different accomplishments to date, and I think, you know, I think much more to come. You have always been perfectly clear about the importance of freedom and the importance of democratic process. And each time you come up into these pressure points where somebody tries to get you to back down, you understand, look, you can't price freedom. You can't trade freedom. You know, this is a core value. You can't compromise. You're totally clear, and you constantly take that stand, like the time with the policeman in New York when you thought you were going to be arrested. You take that stand and you just keep going. And so I think what everybody wants to know is, how can we get some of that? How can we get that?
Sorry, I'm laughing bitterly. I don't know if people are going to like this answer. The belief in freedom, or the willingness to kind of put myself in jeopardy?
Well, there's only one way to assure freedom, and that's to not comply with tyranny.
Right. Exactly.
You have to see it for what it is. You have to call it for what it is, and you have to not comply.
Exactly.
It's that simple.
Yeah, that's simple. I guess what I would say is, I'm lucky and unlucky, and my unluckiness is my luckiness in that regard, which is that, you know, I descend from a family in which the Holocaust happened in the memory of us who knew my grandma. And
your dad was Romanian?
He was Romanian. Yeah.
And they had some of the worst stuff.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
So many losses. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, whether it's family memory and or reading a lot of history of tyranny, I know that as bad as it is to face down a cop in New York City, that's not bad compared with where it's going to go if you don't face down a cop.
Right.
It gets so much worse. So it takes a little bit of, you know, courage to speak up now. It's nothing compared to the courage you're going to need when they're feeding you into a, you know, into an oven. I just have to say it. I was attacked as a child in a very violent and terrifying way, and I survived. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, nothing much scares me anymore. Compared with, I know the worst that human beings can do to each other. And so everything else seems pretty not that scary.
Okay. Tell us how we sign up. Tell us how we find your books. Tell us how we follow you and keep getting inspired by Naomi Wolf.
Thank you. I do need everyone's support, because that's the only way. And we're suing Pfizer and the CDC and the White House and, you know, multiple lawsuits. So please, everyone, go to Amazon and order the War Room Daily Cloud Pfizer Documents Analysis Reports. It's a life-saving book, as I've mentioned. Volume 2 will be coming out in a few months. But Volume 1 is a shocker. And you need to give it to your loved ones, because they often don't know what's hurting. And this will help them. And also my book, The Bodies of Others, is available also on Amazon. And if people can't afford the Pfizer book, you can read the reports right there on Daily Cloud on the upper right-hand corner. They're all available for free. And my Substack is Naomi Wolf, Outspoken.
Right, but we can also become a paying subscriber at Daily Cloud.
You can, and I'd appreciate it if you all would. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay, fly on. Traveling mercies. Thank you, Dr. Naomi Wolf, for everything you're doing. Keep us posted on how we can support you at the Celeria Report. We aim to do so.
I'm so grateful to you. What a thrill to talk to you at last. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.